This is an audio recording of an Arcadia Project seminar given on March the 2nd in Wolfson College, Cambridge by Martin Weller, Professor of Educational Technology at the Open University. His title is At Pedagogy of Abundance, New Teaching Models for a Digital Age. For more information about the Arcadia Project, please visit arcadiaproject.lib.cam.ac.uk.
Lessons we can take from the music industry. I think it's kind of a very interesting sector to look at, both in how they're adapting to change and how they're not adapting. But again, these metaphors are dangerous and stuff. You know. So let's think about the music industry. So in the music industry, talent is scarce. You know, there aren't many very good people around. And it used to be hard to find, so you used to employ these sort of A&R men who'd go around to all these dusty clubs and try and find good acts for you to sign. It's expensive to record, and then what you do is you manufacture a physical resource. And then you manufacture that according to demand, and then you set up a whole distribution chain based around that physical resource. You have record shops, you have distribution warehouses and so on. And access to that resource is actually quite scarce. I mean, I'm sure we can all here remember when you actually used to have to wait for the record shop to open, to go there and buy the record. It's like, and then they might not have it in stock, you might have to order it. So it's kind of the whole model was based around scarcity, really, and controlling that demand and scarcity. And of course, now we have the completely different model. So music has now become abundant. And so what is the model when you have this complete abundance of music, of content? So talent is still scarce, but access to it is now easy. So lots of bands just set up their own spaces online, on MySpace, you know, or whatever. And a lot of them kind of bypass record companies, or they get a following and then go to a record company because then they can say we're an established artist. They're bypassing that model of being discovered. Distribution is kind of instant, and finding these people is really easy. You can create iTunes playlist, you can create a Spotify playlist. If you listen to Last.fm, it will find other artists similar to the ones you like. So suddenly, all the stuff that we used to employ people to go out and find for us, that those people used to act as a filter for us, we can act as the filter ourselves. So this whole model they had before, which is at its very core is based on this notion of scarcity, is beginning to break down. And the music industry kind of doesn't know how to respond to this a lot of the time, and it's been fighting it a lot. So I think this... It's an ironic poster, but it could well be true. So, you know, if you forget the kind of the legalities at the moment, I think that an interesting thing to think about is if you're into downloading illegally music, then if you come across an artist you like, it's as easy to download their entire back catalogue as it is to get one track. And it takes you a bit more time, but storage isn't an issue. You've got massive gigabytes of storage. I saw a 2 terabyte hard drive today for like 100 quid or something. The sort of storage we used to only dream of. So you're not worried about where you store it. You know, you don't have to have. Remember, we used to buy CD cases. You know, those things. Storage isn't a problem. So when it's as easy to get everything as it is to get one track, then our relationship to content and the value of that content changes. So I think you can. So when you respond to this change from scarcity to abundance, there are two types of responses. I think to make it kind of simplistic. So the first is an abundance response. You kind of accept that abundance is happening and try to think how you can take advantage of it. So these might be all classified as kind of abundance responses. So I'm sure everyone knows that the long tails, Chris Anderson's argument that you don't make your money from selling like having big blockbusters, but people like Amazon make their money from selling 2 or 3 of many different titles, which is feasible online, but you can have a massive kind of back catalogue. The freemium model, you know, so you give away some stuff free, but then there are services people pay for on top of that. So Flickr's a very good example of that. You know, lots of us use it completely freely, but if you're really into photography, you want extra storage space, extra services, you'll pay a kind of monthly subscription. There's the notion of kind of selling support services around free content. Open source do this is very well. A lot of open source companies. So the software is free, but actually what people really value in software is someone coming in to set it up for them and having a kind of 24-hour support helpline. So that's the stuff people are willing to pay for. And there may be a kind of analogy there with what we see in education. Perhaps of interest to the kind of the librarians here is the idea is that the digital version of something is free, but you pay for the physical object. So there's publishers like Athabasca Press in Canada and David Wiley's Flat World Publishing, where you can get the digital version of a book free. If you want to pay for the actual book, it's, you know, a standard fee of $25 a month. of course, advertising is the kind of classic model. You know, you try and give away as much as possible there, because what you want to do is bring lots of people to your site, and then you make your revenue through advertising. Another model is kind of you want to promote yourself or whatever, and to give away your content, but the people pay for an experience. And this is what you're seeing lots of music artists do. So they want people to download their stuff free, because actually what they want people to pay for is to come to the concert. Because and I think we're beginning to see people that value these sort of experiences that can't be digitally captured and created and recreated much more. So people do really value going to a concert now and going to a gig and stuff, because that is something that's kind of unique to that experience. So I think it was last year, before, Prince, for instance, gave away his DVD free with the Daily Mail, Spit, but he gave away his album free to kind of generate enough interest when he came and then sold out Wembley for kind of three nights running. And lastly, kind of a software approach is to kind of sell enterprise versions. So you have a big kind of customer base, but then if a company wants to run an enterprise version of your software, you can then set them up and they run it to kind of internet. So these are different ways of kind of accepting that content is often free or abundant, and then trying to sell different things around it or make money off the back of that. And then the scarcity response is, this is the kind of pantomime part. So, you know, digital rights management, the idea is, so that these are kind of trying to argue that we really just want the same models we've always had, but we want to kind of preserve scarcity, if you like. So digital rights management, where you kind of try and control how many copies people have of something, and you control their what devices they can play it on, and how many devices, and if they can copy it or not, and so on. And this usually kind of goes hand in hand with legal enforcement. So, you know, you're very strong kind of legal enforcement, and you stick people in prison or charge them millions of pounds for downloading tracks and stuff. Much favoured by Peter Mandelson, that kind of thing. But on a kind of software, you could argue that kind of subscription model, the type of thing that Murdoch's trying to push through, is also a kind of scarcity response. We want you to pay every month to have access to our content. We don't want you kind of going off there and seeing lots of it. I think, did you have Cory Doctorow?
Yeah.
So this is the type of thing that Corey's going to talk about. You know, that actually things like digital rights management often disadvantage the legitimate customer more than they do the kind of the pirate. So I found this image online the other day, to this guy sort of saying that he says insert DVD, but I think he's going to download illegally and he's straight into his movie. But it's in the States, so he inserts his DVD, he's got to go through an FBI warning, and he's got an unskippable coming soon trailer, another unskippable trailer, and then it goes on, his third trailer, okay, he's still going now, it's going to be going. He gets the menu, okay, I can play it, then he gets the FBI warning again, really don't copy this, and then finally he's into the movie. You know, so going for the legitimate copy and putting all these kind of rights restrictions on kind of makes it more, the legitimate customer kind of has a worse experience than the other one. I just threw it up, so I thought it was a good image. So this is the first of my videos. So I think what happens is, when we're at this kind of space, this tension between these kind of abundance models and scarcity models, you begin to get things that look a bit ridiculous because they're based on the old assumptions. So I'm going to try and play a YouTube clip from a movie that's called RIP, a Remix Manifesto, which some of you may have seen. This may get loud. But it's just going to look at the economics.
Let's do the math. This girl talks song, 21 songs in 3 minutes. Each title is owned by an average of 4 corporations who want at least $2,500 per sample. That makes $210,000 just for the publishers. The recordings are owned by labels, another $52,000. So far, that's $262,500. To clear his album, he'd be looking at well over $4 million. And the best part is that if any of these 85 corporations don't like mashups, they can just
all the flux. Okay, so the point is that, you know, there's kind of a different type of music, and my type of music, you know, the kind of the mashup, remix and stuff, and people are creating something generally new, but the copyright is all based around the whole model of, you know, you're going to take the whole song, you have to pay for the rights for the whole song. So we come on to, you know, how does this relate to education? That's very interesting for music and so on. If you look at the kind of education model, you could argue it's based around the notion that expertise is scarce, just as talent was scarce in music. So the scholar, there aren't many of them, people who are real experts. So what you do is you kind of build your model around that. So learners represent the demand in this respect, and they come to where the expert is, that's the supply. And it makes sense then to group many of these experts together, and hey presto, we've got a university. So you could argue we've got a kind of pedagogy of scarcity, so that the typical lecture is a one-to-many broadcast. There's only the one expert who's broadcasting to many people, because you know, they're scarce. And the library could also be seen as a kind of a pedagogy of scarcity. You know, we have these very precious resources, books that cost lots of money. We'll house them in one place, and people can come and access them. And that kind of makes sense when you're dealing with physical artifacts. So a pedagogy of scarcity tends to be kind of very didactic, instructivist, you know, this is the way you learn, a kind of broadcast model. So really, my question is, and it's for discuss, I haven't really got the answers, is what would a pedagogy of abundance begin to look like if we took some of those things we were seeing in music and thought about them in educational terms? So these are my assumptions about what a pedagogy of abundance would look like. So first of all, even if these don't apply now, I think we can they'll apply soon in your topic or whatever. So let's assume content is free. You know, there's arguments about whether people can pay for it or not, but let's assume content is free. Let's assume it's abundant, you know, across all subject matters, and it's very varied. So it's not just, you know, scholarly articles, but it can be movies, it can be slideshare presentations, podcasts, or whatever. The pedagogy of abundance would have the assumption that sharing is really easy. A blog friend of mine, Scott Leslie, did a really good post last year where he talked about, you know, as he said, he sits in lots of university meetings where we talk about sharing, but we don't actually do much sharing. You know, we kind of university consortia get together and we draw up memorandums of understanding and we talk about building repositories and all this kind of stuff. So, and he compared that with what he does every day online, in blogs and in Twitter and so on. So people just share all the time. And I think partly it's because sharing is just really easy to do. You know, it's if you want to share a video, you take a bit of embed code and stick it in a blog, or it's just a link or something else. So sharing is the kind of the default action that you do. It'd be very kind of social based, I think. And connections between people can be light. You know, it's not a big deal to meet somebody now. We can be connected. Does anyone here follow me on Twitter? Okay, so there's people here, you know, we may not have met, but you know, we have those kind of light connections. Organisation is cheap. I don't know if any of you read Clay Shirky's book, Here Comes Everybody. He gives a really good example there. He talks about a festival or celebration in New York, I think. And how everyone went along to it, took photographs, uploaded them to Twitter, to Flickr rather, and just kind of gave some tags to them. But they didn't organise it. But actually, if you wanted to have a pictorial record of that day, you could just follow the tags for what people put up. And he compares it with what you'd have to have done beforehand. So first of all, you have to get in touch with everybody beforehand who was going, say, will you take photographs? And when you've taken the photographs, will you send them to me? And then I'll publish them in a book and I'll let everyone know. So the cost of organisation has collapsed, effectively. And I think we're only beginning to understand what that means as a society. And I think it'd be based on a generative system. This is Jonathan Zittrain's term from The Future of the Internet. He talks about the beauty of the internet is it's an open system. It's what he calls generative. So it allows people to make stuff and do things in unpredictable ways. That not being able to predict it or control it is kind of key to the system. So in education terms, you would have people doing stuff that you can't predict. And that again, is often quite uncomfortable from an educational point of view. It'd be based, you know, you'd have kind of crowdsourcing, user-generated content, so students kind of sharing content. I mean, it's often said, you know, that education is quite strange in a way. We kind of have a cohort come through every year, and every year when they finish, we throw away everything they've done and don't let the following year see what they've done, which is quite a strange model. And it has the kind of basic assumption that the network is valuable. I was just telling someone before the talk started that I think one of the key skills we should or will teach our students is how to be a valuable member of your network, how to contribute to your network, and how to kind of foster those kind of connections within that network. Now, if I need to know something, I just put a call out to my Twitter network and it will come back kind of straight away. So, and also, they act as my filter in kind of information overload. The social network is my filter. So this is the digression part, okay? This is the diversion part. So I think one way to think about this is almost to have a non-response, but just say openness in a very general sense is our response. So this is what open educational resources used to look like. Does everyone know the term open educational resources? So the idea that universities start to give away free content, started by MIT, and NOU has OpenLearn. But, you know, we used to do the stuff a long time ago, but we used to call it BBC programmes.
And finally, how many digits of pi can you remember? Well, there are several mnemonics which can be used for remembering them. And the word lengths give the successive digits. For example, may I have a large container of coffee? But this one is really my favourite. How I want a drink. Alcoholic, of course. After all those formulas involving tangent functions.
And focus on beer. Okay, so in its way, that was a kind of open educational resource of its day. And so, yeah, we've moved on. So 3 years ago, I was part of a team, but wasn't involved since, that got money from the Hewlett Foundation to set up OpenLearn. And since then, we've set up about 10,000 hours worth of study. We kind of give away to people to come and study freely. They can just take it away and use it. And recently I've been involved in a couple of projects that have been looking at OER use in developing countries. This is just an aside. But it's really interesting that they kind of really value coming to somewhere that's got status and recognition, because taking someone else's stuff is kind of very frowned upon, but it's okay if you're taking it from somewhere that's kind of got a reputation. So having the OU badge of authority in this stuff kind of really, really matters. If you haven't seen OpenLearn stuff, then this is what it looks like. So we've got stuff across all subject areas. We also kind of put together a load of tools down the side that people can use. So there's a Flash meeting, which is kind of a live conference system, so you can get together and chat. The learning clubs are quite interesting. So the idea is that people come together around a subject area. So for instance, we've got a course on how to write creative fiction, and so there's a kind of creative fiction writer club that's come together around that content. So it's not just about the content. This was so looking at your, this is great, yeah, so you can work out your carbon footprint and stuff from one of our level one courses and stuff. So it's just kind of across the spectrum. But one of the things we kind of realised and knew anyway is that openness isn't just about content. A few years ago, people started saying, you know, content isn't king, but because content isn't king doesn't mean it's nothing either, but you need to kind of wrap stuff around it, I think. So at the OU, we've got what we could kind of grandiosely term an ecosystem of openness, but we're kind of trying to find lots of things to do, I think, here. And a part of this is just kind of experimenting, finding our way. I showed you that BBC clip. I think previously at the OU, our identity was often wrapped up with that kind of learning zone BBC Two programme. But as that's kind of changed, I think we're trying to evolve a new digital identity. I think that digital identity is based around this concept of openness. So we've got iTunes U. So if you go to iTunes University, we've got stuff there. We're sort of amongst the top downloads there. So I think it's sort of 10 million. We've got our own podcast site. We did have Open2.net, which is related to the BBC stuff. That's merging into OpenLearn. We've got our own YouTube channel, and that's evolving. I think the idea is the YouTube channel will become the kind of default output for everything. We're just going to put lots of stuff up there. Everything we make will go through the YouTube channel. We've got Platform, which is kind of a social network for students. And we've got Facebook. I know some of you would have come across Tony Hurst. Tony Hurst kind of developed a couple of Facebook apps for OU students, and it allows them to find each other. And that's really interesting. So we're like the biggest UK university on Facebook now. We've got tons of, we've got about 20,000 students who've signed up there. And going back to this idea of unpredicted consequences and the generative system. So the OU was running this scheme with Tesco, where you could use your Tesco club card points to count towards OU study. And recently, for reasons I'm not entirely sure, thanks to the financial cutbacks, they've changed that scheme so that it's only for level one students. And the OU students used Facebook as the kind of point of their rebellion and revolution against it. So they kind of, they would set up a kind of a page in protest against this, and within days there was kind of like thousands of OU students on there kind of protesting about this, organising their campaign to kind of write to MPs and stuff. And it's really interesting to watch, you know. And as the OU, we're a bit uncomfortable about it, but this is the kind of thing you can't predict when you kind of open these kind of networks up. We've got a system called CloudWorks, which I could show them, which is kind of social networking, gathering together content for academics, as well. We've also got OpenLearn, and we run some OU Twitter accounts, as well as lots of kind of individuals being on Twitter. So that these are all kind of different ways of trying to interact with students and the general public, both in terms of dialogue and around content. This is my digression part, so bear with me. I think you can kind of think about open educational resources, there being two approaches to it. One is kind of big OER, which are things like OpenLearn, MIT, OpenCourseWare. These are kind of big institutional projects that have lots of funding, and the stuff that comes out of them is kind of got the seal of approval and stuff, and it's branded material. And then I think you can think about little OER, which is kind of the stuff that individuals produce, and that can be YouTube videos, blog posts, all that kind of stuff. And I'm kind of quite interested in little OER, because I think this is the kind of stuff where you see the kind of real creativity. But they're very different. I want to show you something. So the type of stuff I do, which is like very unacademic, is this. So I was asked to, JISC ran an online conference last year, and I was asked to give a talk about higher education in 20 years' time. So I didn't just want to give a talk, so I made a little video, so just bear with me on the video. It's not high quality.
Hello, I'm Martin Weller, and today I'm going to take part in a remarkable experiment. Through some kind of magic wormhole, I'm using this device that's on the church here, this magical piece of technology, I'm going to create a small wormhole and be able to interview myself in the future. So I'm going to jump forward to about the year 2020, I think, and hopefully have an interview with myself. I'm going to ask them lots of important questions about the future of education. So let's see how it goes. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Is happening, I think? Hello, hello from the future. Yes, it's me here, Martin talking. Yes, yes, I can hear you. It's a bit...
Okay. So, the point is then other people started making similar interviews with the future videos. And so around that conference, I do try and make some kind of serious points in the talk about, you know, how things go on. We could then refer to these kind of different videos as a kind of ongoing dialogue. And so what you had was a kind of different response to that kind of little OER than you get to big OER. What we find with the big OER stuff is people take it as it is. They don't do anything with it. It's like, this is lovely, thanks, it's OU quality material, I'll just take it and teach. Whereas what you find with your kind of little OER, which could just be a blog post or whatever, people tend to interact with it and do different types of things around it. And so, this is just to kind of pose a question. It's like, so, is it that just being open and generative is actually a response to abundance? So it's almost a kind of non-response. We just say, look, we're going to be open and we're going to wait and see what happens. We don't know what will happen, but we're going to take a general policy of openness. We publish all our material openly. Whenever we give talks, we put them up on SlideShare. So we're just going to, we have a general policy of openness, and we'll just wait and see what happens. On to the kind of more pedagogic sort of responses. So these are some of the contenders, I think, for a pedagogy of abundance. So resource-based learning, this kind of sort of posits that the resource is the kind of the main thing. So it's the interaction between the learner and the resource that is the kind of structuring device of learning. So you try and give people good resources and a good framework within which to interact with those resources. Problem-based learning is kind of often closely allied with resource-based learning. So in problem-based learning, you give people what's called an ill-structured problem, so something which there isn't a definite solution, but which they need to then work through, and often in groups, you know. And so by working through the problem, they then come to understand the subject. And then the teacher's role there is much more kind of that of a facilitator, you know. So this is what you need to do, and perhaps you give them some kind of starting resource and so on. So you can see both with resource-based learning and problem-based learning, these are kind of quite well suited to a model of abundance and lots of free content to deal with. Constructivism was kind of all the rage 10 years ago. It's more of a learning theory, so it kind of suggests that learning is kind of a very active process where learners should, they have to discover principles and stuff for themselves. It's a very kind of personal, socially constructed way of learning, and it's obviously kind of, I think, better suited to some subject matters than others. You know, it often doesn't really apply very well in science, for instance, if you don't really want to have to go and discover Einstein's principles for yourself. But you can see how that might work online. So you're kind of trying. It's part of it's about. It's kind of really emphasising the idea of dialogue and interaction and working with other people. And similarly, the concept of communities of practice. So here the idea is that you join a community, and I think open source communities are often a very good example of this. So you join a community, and by just observing what other people do in that community, you begin to learn. It's almost like a kind of cognitive apprenticeship. And you engage in tasks that are legitimate, and it's called legitimate peripheral participation. So it's not just doing pseudo-tasks like you're doing in education, it's doing real things, and by doing those, you kind of progress into the centre of the community. And so you see this already online a lot, and you see it in lots of different types of communities, and often there's kind of practices. If you're a new person to the community, don't go asking the obvious questions, kind of hang around, watch what happens, those kind of things. And connectivism is... Again, I wouldn't say it's kind of a full pedagogy, but it's kind of a set of principles proposed by George Siemens in Canada. He's really kind of trying to posit the connections as a kind of core learning area. So I think it's one of the few approaches and ways of thinking that really sort of takes the network and that as a kind of starting point. So he says learning is a process of connecting specialised nodes. So making those connections is what's important. And kind of going back to what I was saying about one of the valuable things for students to learn is how to be a member of a network. He says sort of nurturing and maintaining connections is kind of a core skill, and you should really work at that kind of every day. And also abilities to see connections between fields and ideas. It's kind of, so it's not just working within your discipline, but across disciplines. Okay, so this is my kind of wrap-up slide. I don't know if I've been ultra quick or not. I think... there are three possible conclusions, perhaps more, that you can draw from what I've been trying to argue in that whistle-stop tour through pedagogy. First is that there isn't anything in this pedagogy of abundance. A lot of those principles we saw and the kind of stuff that happens in music doesn't really apply to education. It's kind of it's different enough that we don't really need to be concerned about those things. The second response, I think, is that we have enough theories at the moment that all those things I went through, but perhaps they weren't initially put forward as theories with a kind of a network world view out there. So perhaps we just need a bit of recasting to bear in mind some of those assumptions that I put up earlier. And the last theory, the last possible conclusion, is that none of these existing theories kind of really quite gets to what's happening in society at the moment, with kind of it's very fundamental changes between how people communicate and how we relate to content and the change from scarcity to abundance. And actually, we do need a new theory to accommodate these things. So that's my kind of ending point. I'd like to go for discussion. So it was kind of a half-baked idea, but I'm trying to work through this notion of how abundance relates to education.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thoughts, questions, comments, disagreements?
EMI is in the process of going bust. Is that because the amount of value that they created for society, for music listeners, was actually half what we thought it was?
Partly. I think it's also a failure to understand what was happening in their industry, and their response to be to try and continually fight it and lock it down rather than embrace it, It's still an amazing thing that we have stopped thinking is amazing, that the biggest record company in the world is a computer company, and not a record company, so the biggest record store. So, and where did that change come from? Why wasn't it EMI? Why wasn't it Virgin? And so that was a kind of complete failure to understand. And often that's, if you've read Clayton Christensen's stuff, about disruptive technologies and... then the problem is that often the incumbents fail to see what's happening because they want to make... stuff better for their existing customers, and EMI's existing customers were people come to their shops or they come to existing artists. So you've put all this money into this and built this big infrastructure around this stuff, and suddenly it can't be worth nothing. That's kind of you can't have that thought. So they kind of have to carry on building and building that, and I think then suddenly the crash hits them very hard. And partly what you say is true, the kind of the value of those things is a lot less than we thought, particularly if people start to buy tracks rather than albums. You know, in Everything is Miscellaneous, David Weinberg has this excellent sort of paragraph, he says, we thought the unit of music was the album, but actually that turns out that was just the way it was because it was a physical artifact, and that was the kind of most economical way to bundle that together. As soon as stuff went into iTunes, you found that the actual unit of granularity was the track, because that's what people tend to buy, one or two tracks. And we hadn't seen that before, so the kind of the bundling together of those economics kind of all split apart when everything went digital. So
that atomism, that atomistic concept of what it is that people are buying, applying that to education, it seems to an awful lot of the incumbents, wherever on the chain they think they're adding value, really scary.
Yeah, I think if you could look at you could look at music as offering a number of services that were bundled together for convenience. One was those sort of finding music, recording it, distributing it, and acting as a filter for you. And in a kind of very reductionist sense, you could look at education as having a number of services also. And one is providing content, whether that's through the lecture and so on. But it has a number of other services, and maybe we'll see those services begin to splinter. So other services are things like offering support, so the kind of tutorial, and perhaps the kind of jewel in the crown for them economically is accreditation. You know, so you can learn everything you like through Google, but it's difficult to get a job kind of proving that. So at the moment we kind of bundle those things together, and maybe you can almost view it kind of like covalent, from my A-level chemistry, the kind of the bonds holding the ionic or covalent bonds holding something together in a molecule. It's like in the music industry, they were actually quite weak, and the kind of digital catalyst split them apart. And maybe they're stronger in education, those bonds. It makes, for a student, a learner, it's still a convenient package to have bundled together. But we shouldn't rely on that all the time. And newspapers are seeing a similar thing, where they were lots of things bundled together in one physical package. And actually, when you go online, those things become unbundled, you know, very easily. So I think in education, some of those services are much more difficult to unbundle. But certainly, I was reading a post by someone today who said they were studying economics somewhere and their lectures were kind of completely incomprehensible. So they went to Academic Earth and just looked at a Harvard lecturer there who's doing economic lectures and passed their exam by studying completely free content. And they are, so why am I paying to go to university? You know, it's like, actually, what I want is the accreditation. So if a university started to offer that accreditation free, you know, turn up and for $100 you can have your accreditation, then you might begin to see those things unbundled.
I think there's a lot more in the music analogy than you brought up. I mean, one of the other things was that, because I think one of the great mysteries about music was, why did the record companies miss it? Because music was digital from 1982, when the CDs appeared. That means that what a music company had to do was it had musicians who made noise in a studio and created bit streams, and it had people at home with machines that could convert bit streams into noise, and the problem was, how do you get the bit streams from one place to the next?
Yeah.
And initially you could only do that with plastic discs, and they had all kinds of economic restrictions. One of them was that it was uneconomic to do tracks. You had to bundle them together, and then the internet arrives, which is a machine for transferring bits from one place to another. You'd have thought it was heaven sent for the industry.
You would have thought so. Yeah.
And somehow the record industry kind of ignored it. Now, I'd really like to know why. Was it to do with the kind of people who ran the industry? Was it to do with the way they were incentivized? For example, music executives were incentivized to sell plastic discs, not to sell. And the other thing is that the demand for. There are two people in this room who are old enough to remember the Grateful Dead. I'm one, and I won't name the other person. The Grateful Dead were very interesting because they, as a band, spotted from the beginning that there was something to be said for letting their fans make bootleg recordings and give them away. And in fact, the Grateful Dead became one of the most successful bands of all time, despite, in terms of finance, despite allowing their fans to take their stuff and give it away free. So they were a very interesting case of the freemium model that worked, and they were doing this in 1972.
Yeah.
So, someday, I think, business schools will have case studies for first-year students which are to do with the psychotherapy or psychotherapeutic aspects of the record industry and the net.
Can you see Google infringing on this?
Well, that is when I was doing this project. John talked about it last year, social learn. Part of that was kind of to try and build a social network for learning. And one of our PVCs used to say that the thing that he wakes up in the night and comes to it is that Google suddenly says, "We're going to do this." It's almost like the evil eye of Mordor swept around the education. You know, it's like and you're seeing it with kind of technology. You know, sort of. The OU, for instance, we've now signed over to Google to provide all our apps for students, which is great because they get fantastic technology, and there's no point in us, we might just outsource that. But you know, as they're beginning to kind of digitise all the books and stuff, they may well decide actually we can sell services around this. You know, if you're reading kind of one of the standard textbooks, there's a little button at the top that says, you know, people offer Skype tuition on this for $50 an hour, and you can click the button and away you go. You know, so I think part of the thing that holds it all together is that is the kind of social recognition still, you know, is that kind of accreditation. You know, obviously a Cambridge that degree kind of it counts for a lot. You know, it's not,
we could do that through a system like Wikipedia, where actually, you know, the University of Cambridge owns 50 subjects in Wikipedia. And you can become accredited through it.
Yeah. So I think we'll see a lot more. And to be fair, I think a lot of universities are trying to think about how they that boundary between informal and formal learning, kind of how we bridge that, because we are beginning to recognise that people, what people are engaging in every day is learning, and we shouldn't just kind of separate that out from what we do. You know, there's kind of lots of valuable stuff that goes on there.
Sometimes I wonder if we think some of the phenomena is as what we think is very new, when in fact often it's just become popular over time. There were fax machines in the 40s. And before the record companies could digitize and split up, they had compilation albums of greatest hits. And then individuals, when they discovered cassettes, did their own compilations. Yeah. And so in a way, we turn to the same sort of tools as we find available. But some of it is activation energy. Has to be enough distribution of the tools. And in a way, your second proposal, I think, maybe that we have some theories out there, but it's sort of how to cleverly engage what we already know and see is available, with the warning that very often what's popular isn't necessarily what's going to persist.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, is a concern.
Yeah. I think in terms of stuff being there before, that's true. There's a certain stage where something becomes so easy to do, or the scale of it becomes so large, it becomes almost a different thing in itself. And I think sharing music is a really interesting thing. So you're absolutely right, you know, but I used to make mixtapes with my friends, but you have to spend as long as the mixtape took to record it, then you'd have to give it away, so you wouldn't own the copy. So actually, sharing was quite a difficult thing, you know. So, and it was an act of love, you know. You kind of, when you've got a girlfriend, you'd make a mixtape for her. But now making a playlist is like incidental to what you do. So suddenly, that the cost of that sharing becomes an absolutely different being altogether.
Sorry. I'm sorry. No, the educational comparison, I think, is important. That once you made a mixtape that your mates liked, they would copy them.
Yeah.
And that was in the same sort of way of saying, well, you've got good taste in music, and I want that too, and so does the person in the background.
Yeah.
So.
But now that network is kind of global, isn't it? So you're kind of sharing not just with your mates, but with anyone who comes across you on Last FM who's got a similar profile. So it's kind of a different scale of change, I think. But I think you're absolutely right about the things that are popular now not persisting. I think you had a quote on your blog recently. It was like, people say, why don't we just give this stuff over to Google, and how many technology companies are 500 years old or whatever. You know, it's like, well,
not many.
One knows how far you think these ideas of socioeconomic ideas can go as they permeate through education. I mean, one of the things, up to about 3 or 4 years ago, I think most people in general here said, Google could do everything universities can do except award degrees. Google at the moment can only award degrees, either from Apple, either from Microsoft. But so what we've got, we have accreditation, but what about community accreditation? Is it possible that in the future, a community accrediting, saying you're the expert, will count for more than a degree from Cambridge? And we've already seen examples of it in the blogosphere. Now, Martin is what's known as an A-list blogger, this sort of thing, and there's a guy called Stephen Downs and Michael Feldstein, and all these guys have got international global reputation. Some of them, like Feldstein, actually got a huge job with Oracle off the bat, probably, of his blog as much as anything. Now, I'm not aware that Martin or any of these other gentlemen have ever done a degree in blogging or have ever been accredited. Mm-hmm. The community has decided that these guys and women are worth reading, and some of them are then making money off the back of it. So how far can this go?
I mean, and you're right, this kind of reputation thing is very interesting, and sometimes we just kind of decide it for ourselves, or it's through seeing how other people talk about them. But then other times there are metrics for doing that, you know, so there's a kind of eBay reputation and stuff, but all these things can always be gained. But I think that's going to be a really interesting thing, and actually something that becomes really valuable. I thought about doing a different talk, which was about kind of academic identity and how it's kind of split over different kind of areas, so it could be one place in Blogger or over here. So that's my stuff. And how valuable that identity is, and it's almost your digital identity will be your academic identity, and so you really have to kind of work to maintain it and build it up, and it's very valuable. And if someone becomes subject to attack or something, you know, it's like, then that's kind of a very costly exercise.
There's a LinkedIn example where employers are now, people are actually checking people's credentials on LinkedIn.
Yes, I just wanted to pull out that there seem to be two strands there. One of how these phenomena affect existing study, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, how they generate new forms of study, so that you have those free resources that were on the OU site, which are in parallel with charged courses, or complementary,
sometimes they are parts of existing courses, and sometimes they are deceased courses. So it's kind of free content you can just take and use. Kind of, you don't have to come back to us again. But that relates to how that relates to, does it bring students into us, or do we lose students to it? It's still kind of unknown, I think. And in general, I think the consensus at the moment, it seems to be bringing people into us. But if we went for the completely open model where all of our content was online, would we then lose students? I think that.
Today, James Murdoch was on the radio from BBC talking about how the BBC had completely torpedoed private enterprise, various media businesses, the richest dad had in large hands. Do you see that the Open University or other major providers of large scale free to use educational information might be doing the same for the private sector? And where do you think the boundaries should lie in a mixed democratic, open market economy like the UK?
That's a very interesting. I've never thought about it in terms of the private sector. I mean, you think about it in terms of relationship to other universities. You know, it's like in some ways the OU is different because we haven't got the campus experience to sell, if you like. You know, and part of going away to college is that campus experience. So we're not competing there. But in terms of, I wonder whether there would be a challenge. You know, if we give away free content, I've had some run-ins online with someone who became a millionaire through running one of these kind of training companies. So you know, he's very much, you should pay for content kind of stuff, you know, something. So I guess he would see that we're kind of scuppering the money. I heard the James Murdoch thing, and he I think you might have a hidden agenda there, I'm not sure.
But the interesting thing about the Murdoch thing is that actually Sky is bigger than the BBC.
That's
not, and in relation, just applying that straight back to the education thing, actually, although the EU is very big compared to universities, compared to Pearson, it isn't. So it's a very interesting question. And you use very light BBC.
As John knows, I'm a publisher.
That is the interesting relationship to have over the next few years.
Sorry.
I'm more worried that the economy shouldn't turn out to be right, and that I think the number of people who are interested in knowledge, which I'm safe, is relatively small. Most of the students are interested and the utility of that knowledge, and of course the accreditation that you get from coming here. And these days, because on the eBay type websites you can buy professional services from India very, very cheaply, I think the number of people who've got the incentive to do so is going to diminish.
I don't know if that's true. I think people actually, certainly my experience of community online, people, they tend to be much more effective, and people seem quite willing to learn, but it's whether they want to learn in the way we've set up for them, I think, is the thing. So, you know, and so there's probably something in between that. I just want to know I want to go to the 5-minute university and watch a YouTube clip, or I want to sign up for a 3-year undergrad course. I think at the moment I once did a very extended, laboured metaphor about education as fruit, and at the moment we kind of sell apples. They come in different sizes, but it's basically apples, and we concentrate on different ways of packaging apples. But, you know, if you really wanted to kind of open education up, you're going to have the whole variety of fruits that come in many different sizes and shapes, you know, and people could take them away and mix them up and do what they want with them. So I think
it's like the supermarket metaphor, though. The choice is wonderful, therefore if we have more choice we'll consume more, whereas there's another view that says choice is just confusing and so I won't have any apples.
Yeah. But I think we can do more to be more flexible, I think, to meet the needs of different types of learners at different stages during life. You know, so the idea that it's just you come here for 3 years and then go away, you know, so, and we began to tinker with that, but not a lot, I think. You know, it's like John does the kind of relevant knowledge program, you know, it's like sort of 10-week courses, but I think, you know, people are prepared to start signing up for those.
Well, looking at it from the producer's point of view, is there any status in the number of hits, for instance, on an open drawing course? And how do you get value as a creator, as a teacher, out of the material that's gone?
That's an excellent question. I run a project at the OU called Digital Scholarship now, and that's precisely what we're trying to do. And I think it's very problematic because we kind of know what a good journal article looks like, basically. So at the moment, you kind of get promotion by sort of showing you've got excellence in teaching and research. We kind of know what these things look like. You know, you've had certain research grants from respected bodies, you've been published in the good journals, you've given keynote speeches, those kind of things. But what does a good blog look like? You know, so you can have, it's not number of posts, it's not necessarily number of links. You know, you could be posting, you know, Paris Hilton pictures and get loads of links, but it's not kind of an education blog. So it's a very difficult thing to. So it's a much kind of fuzzier area. And I have in my mind this kind of wonderful metric system where we could like look at all the different places where you might exist online and have different ways of measuring that activity. And it kind of give you some kind of measure of your impact. You know, the ref at the moment is kind of obsessed with impact, but actually what it means is publishing in these respective journals that are recognised in these databases. And so they're not really measuring this impact at all. And I think you can look at a lot of the people who are very active online. I don't know if you've seen Michael West's videos. You know, he has millions of hits, this guy. You know, it's like, but it doesn't mean he's necessarily well published, but you know, they're kind of things that really go out there and sort of encourage dialogue and things. So if you want to make an argument about impact, I think there's certainly lots of other ways we can look at it. And a few universities are beginning to kind of scratch away at this now. You know, what does it mean, particularly in things like humanities? A lot of different types of output there, I think. But it's very difficult to kind of measure. And we've got the incumbents model. We kind of know what these things look like. That's nice, neat, and orderly. Whereas this other stuff is very messy and stuff.
Back on the point about the sort of publisher concern, you had mentioned earlier about sort of the Prince example of giving away the music and then people buying tickets for the experience. Mm. It seems the OU has been one of the sort of key lights in working a similar sort of example, which is people still want to gather together. So that's why all the regional sections.
And
that model has been so powerful that a private enterprise in the States, Phoenix University, has basically stolen the same model. So yes, you can do it all online or sent to you or however it means, but that doesn't get to the seminar experience. Or the mates with whom you can go down the pub.
I think we want to try and facilitate that kind of connection much more informally, which is why we create these Facebook apps. It allows students to find each other and say, no, let's get together. Sometimes online they'll just go into a kind of a flash meeting session, but often it's kind of let's get together down the pub. And I've got a colleague who works up at the University of Highlands and Islands in Isle of Lewis, and he said he's seen their study centres change. It used to be that people had to come there to access the technology, so these would often be like a room in a school or in a cafe or something within the local village, but now everyone's got their technology at home, so they don't need to come, but they still come together because they want to come together once a week to have that kind of social engagement. So those study centres are still actually really important, and I think before we kind of downplayed that kind of the social significance in learning, certainly.
Well, the CompuServe was as old as the internet, and their earliest examples were the same thing. People still wanted regional epicenters. And in fact, most of us experienced the conference phenomenon. phenomenon of getting more done around the coffee and tea.
Yeah.
There was still something going on in those sort of moments. Yeah. And whether people analyze that well or not, they will gravitate.
It's certainly, it's like the kind of reading club model. You kind of want to set up the kind of informal study clubs. You know.
Is it not always also the case in, say, a university like Cambridge, which is that students learn a lot from one another? But perhaps do we acknowledge that, or I mean, is that the experience that people have?
In a way, it's part of that learning to be part of a community experience we mentioned earlier. But do we evaluate? Yes.
When we do. I mean, we know it can be done. The trouble is, like many things in the world we're living at the moment, it's almost impossible to measure.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's difficult to talk about it. It's certainly engineering or academic. We're unhappy about talking about things we can't measure.
I think in a campus university, you can almost sit the physical structure is built up to encourage that kind of dialogue. So we have cafeterias and bars and stuff. It's like, and that's when that stuff happens. But it's different online. We're only beginning to kind of recreate that kind of casual. That's what I said about the connections being light. You know, it's like, you used to have kind of forums and discussions, but often they're kind of a bit hard work to get into. But you can easily have a kind of a Facebook connection with somebody or a Twitter connection with somebody, and so you have this kind of very informal dialogue going on around people all the time.
The other thing, the point you made before, which is whether you encourage communication outside the cohort, because I've been in exactly the same thing you're referring to, where what I should really tell the students is to go and talk to people who did it last year, find out what they're saying. And I sometimes do tell them, so I tell them I shouldn't be telling them.
Yeah, I know, which is bizarre.
Because if they want to learn, the thing to do is to go and speak to people who did the project last year, see what mistakes they made, and learn from that experience, and that way they get lots of learning, really, for the price of one.
I mean, you see in open source communities, you know, the archive of the discussions is a very, very valuable learning resource, and they kind of they promote that when you come in, go and look at the FAQs, all that kind of stuff. This is where we've been, so that dialogue is presented as a learning resource, whereas we tend to kind of like stick it all in the bin.
And doesn't that come back to the point about the music industry, which is that universities ought to do that, and yet it's kind of, it provokes shock horror among academics, that thought that you would tell this generation of students what last generation of students did. And it's almost as if the system is set up in such a way as to prevent what it really ought to be allowing to happen. And that's just one example, I think.
When John and I ran this online course, I had a tutor get in touch with me and said, I've got some students who want to get together down the pub to meet. Should I tell them not to, because it gives them an unfair advantage? And then said, a couple who are married. And I said, yeah. And you tell them not to talk about it over the breakfast table. And all that stuff.
There are a lot of... When we started this course, we wanted to set books, and we told our purchasing department to get some copies of it. And the purchasing department came back and said, sorry, you can't have this course, because why not? And the answer was, because those set books are not published in the United Kingdom. And we said, this is a course about how the internet is changing the world. And it just goes on and on and on, and it's still happening.
Right. Attention is not in abundance. Attention is very scarce still, so that's an issue. So the abundance relates to abundance of content and resource, and part of the problem of dealing with that is how to know what to read. So that kind of filter process. And to quote David Weinberg again, he talks about, we used to have filter on the way in, so you know, that's what publishers did, that's what recording companies did. They found the good stuff for us. That's what broadcasters do. This is what you need to know. And it's what lecturers do. You know, this is the reading list. Well, here's the lecture. This is the important stuff. And when you have abundance of content, what you do is filter on the way out. So you allow everything to go up. You don't, you know, YouTube doesn't say this needs to pass our quality threshold, you know, before you put it up. You chuck everything up, and that's what the blogosphere does. But then you filter on the way out through things like reputation, through search, through numbers of hits, and all that. So having that, so finding those new types of filters, I think, is absolutely key. And going back to my thing about, you know, being part of a network. So you know, your social network becomes your filter, effectively. So that's certainly one filter. You find stuff through other people, and because you know them, you trust what they recommend, and that becomes a super powerful filter. You know, you're absolutely right. Kind of attention.
One concern is that we always talk about this as though it's new. There is more now. That things are different now than they ever have been before. And I think that people always, like, originally I was a 17th century scholar, but it's a great sense that everything was new.
I think, you know, what you say is true, certainly, and there's a tendency to always to be in the moment. So this is the big revolution, but I think we are going through a revolution, and I think it's, and okay, Shirky says it's when something becomes everyday and pervasive, that's when the revolution's happening. It's not that this stuff is going to happen. It's when it's the mobile phone is the revolution technology. It's when it becomes kind of commonplace, that's when it's truly remarkable in a way. And I think, you know, we have seen that, and the changes in these kind of what we thought were well-established industries, you know, and with the BBC thing out today, you know, they're talking about how, you know, everybody's competing for the same space, and often these, what we thought were separate industries, have more in common, the digital versions, with each other than they do with their previous versions of themselves, you know. So, and that is a kind of a remarkable change we're seeing in what we thought we understood about economics and newspapers and the music industry and broadcasting, and to some extent kind of education. So I think we haven't seen that, you know, since the Gutenberg Press, you know, so that these kind of things are very substantial changes, I think.
Anybody else?
Yes.
Is that sense of competition, is that behind a distinction between seeing other people's work or not seeing it? So that if you have a researcher, then clearly they would need to see the work of the people that have gone before them. They're not competing, in a sense, for a better mark in the exam with the other PhD researchers, whereas the undergraduates.
I think it's just partly it's, it might just be a, maybe what you say is true, but it may just be a hangover from when there was nothing else to see, really. We gave lectures, we did exams, and that was it. So it didn't have this kind of the digital discussion artifact to kind of hang around. So, and we're just kind of used to that model. And I think there's also a kind of the kind of equality argument comes in. People, if I'm in the first year of the cohort, then that's not as fair as someone who's gone through it 10 years running. They've got this extra resource to draw on, so we'll just put everyone on the level playing field and give nobody access to that. And I think also we just don't like, generally when we do teaching, we want it to be the same every year. And the idea that the course would mutate and evolve over its lifetime with lots of student contributions is an alien concept, I think, to teaching.
Okay,
that's it.
Yeah.
Just
thinking about the idea of reputation versus accreditation in the context of a first degree.
Yeah.
Those students doing a first degree probably aren't really particularly creative most of the time. They're consuming information. And they're probably not blogging very much or writing anything particularly interesting. They're just doing the same degree program, slightly different degree program than the students. Do you see there being a way to replace a first degree, or is that going to stay around forever regardless of what else happens?
I think part of what you can be doing in that first degree is teaching those skills. And I remember when I did my first degree, on the first day I was in psychology, so don't throw me out, but they said, no, when you finish here, you'll forget most of what you've learned here, but you'll remember the process of being a scientist. And we kind of thought, no, we kind of think it's the exciting content you're not doing, but we're absolutely right. You know, what it's part of that becoming in a community practice, you learnt how to be an academic. So we kind of do that already. You learn how to write articles, you learn how to write essays, you learn how to do research, you know, and how to interpret and analyse results and those kind of things. So we do that already, and I think you could move some of those skills forward as well. So you could learn how to be a part of a network community, you know, and how to contribute to that community and how to maintain those connections. You could learn how to...
A different set of skills to say learning a hard science topic. You know, there's a lot of actual information and ways of working with the systems that have been developed over many years by the scientists who've gone before you.
There is,
but being taught.
Yeah, but I mean, but also when you're doing a science degree, you will be learning lots of things. But often it's like how to use the stats packages. There's a certain kind of, you know, these are the skills you need.
These are the
skills you need to be part of to be a kind of recognised academic or scholar in the area. And so when you come out of your undergraduate degree, you're kind of recognised as having done some of that kind of groundwork. And I think these other skills are equally part of that, you know, and certainly science is, you know, as much a community as anywhere else. And, you know, I was listening to the kind of Climate Gate reports this morning, you know, and I think part of the argument there is that as researchers, we're so used to kind of holding on to data and wanting to control how people interpret, you know. I kind of have every sympathy for what he went through. It's like, because he kind of thinks, I know they're going to take something, they're going to interpret it the wrong way, so I'll try and preempt that by doing it. It's like, and actually, it's this kind of learning to let go and learning to kind of be open and share data and stuff is actually quite alien to a lot of what we do as a researcher. But I still think that those would be part of a kind of set of generic skills that you could almost pull through in any subject.
Okay, I think I'll stop it there, if I may. Thank you very much, Martin. And thank you all for coming, and please remember that there's some wine at the back of the room if you'd like some. Can I just draw your attention to two things that are coming up? The first is that on April the 30th we have the second Arcadia lecture. It will be given by Daniel Cohen from George Mason University, whom some of you will know as a very distinguished scholar in the digital humanities area, and also as the lead developer on the Zotero plugin tool for Firefox. And in 2 weeks' time we have another seminar, this time given by Dave Patton from Huddersfield, on how to make intelligent use of what you learn from borrowing records, which is of great interest to some of us. Thanks very much, Martin. Thank you, Martin.